Cambridge Business English Certificate, Higher, an examination preparation course. Copyright Linguarama International 2000 and produced for Summertown Publishing.
Unit 1A. Work roles. Listening.
I've just moved from a company with a very strict hierarchy to a fast-growing software company. It's been hard coming to terms with the changes. I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy my new job a lot more. I have a lot more responsibility now, and everything's done in project teams and managed by objectives. The one thing I do miss, however, is that now, once a project's running, the team's pretty much on its own and left to solve any problems by itself. Before, there was always a superior I could turn to for help. And to be honest, I'd be much happier if that were still the case, especially when you're starting a new job. Having someone to talk to can make things a lot easier.
I produce technical documents, you know, user's manuals, nothing creative, I'm afraid. Our team's responsible for its own work schedules, and as long as finished before the machine shipped, it's up to us when we do it. So you'd think with email and everything, we'd all be able to work from home or come and go as we please, but unfortunately it's a very conservative company, so everyone's still clocking in and out at the same time. I suppose the managers have always worked a routine 9-to-5. I just can't imagine anything else being possible.
I'm an IT consultant and I'm working for a small leisure group on a one-year contract. So I'm travelling around Europe a lot, which I know sounds very glamorous, but it's just a case of jetting in, fixing a hotel's computer, and then jetting out again. It also means I'm on call and work very, shall we say, flexible hours, including many weekends. Oh, and I'm also responsible for the website, which I work on from home. What I miss is support from colleagues, you know, being able to discuss problems or things like the latest technology with other IT professionals in the same job. So, yes, it's definitely the social side of my job I'd like to improve.
Well, I'm a temp, and I'm working as a PA for a law firm in London just now. It's a medium-sized firm that's grown quickly, so its organisation is very much like that of a smaller company. OK. I know it's unreasonable to expect a definite job description. I mean, if something needs doing, then I think whoever's available should do it. But I'm already responsible for managing the diaries and correspondence of two senior managers. So when the telephone's ringing all day and people keep asking me to photocopy reports or even make them coffee, it just becomes impossible to get anything done.
I work for the UK subsidiary of a Japanese company, and it's very Japanese in terms of the way it's run. I've just got a new boss who's come over from Japan. We seem to be getting on pretty well at the moment. He always has time for me and gives me lots of support. The only thing is, I don't really have a huge say in what I do, well, which is all right, but sometimes it would be nice to be able to show a bit of initiative. Our work processes are totally standardised as fixed routines, which I don't mind. It's just that I always have to consult him before I can make even the smallest alteration to any job of any sort.
Unit 1B, Company Structure. Listening.
So, Neil, why did BT decide to introduce Options 2000?
Well, we started looking at flexible working back in 1993, and subsequent staff surveys showed that 96% of our office-based staff wanted to work at home 2 or 3 days a week. We thought about how we could respond to this, and soon realised that flexible working was very much a win-win-win situation. It's a win for technology, using our own products and practising what we preach, and of course it reduces BT's office space and cuts costs. But I think the real driver for change was accepting that our people wanted to work differently.
Right. And how many of them will actually end up working from home?
Our target's 10,000 by the end of the year.
10,000?
Yes. That's out of about 55,000 office-based staff.
Hmm. And what effect has this had on company structure?
Well, the company's been organised around business units for some time now. It used to be very much departmentalised, with work being done in series, you know, passed from one department to the next. But product life cycles are a lot shorter nowadays. For the internet, say, it's less than 6 months even. So people come together for a specific purpose and then go off to join new projects when the job's done.
Hmm. So these organisational changes must have had quite an effect on BT's culture.
Well, as I said, we've been developing a project-oriented culture. So people now are paid for what they actually do and not for sitting at a desk from 9 to 5. But the really fundamental change is that we've become a lot more collaborative, both internally and in our dealings with partners and clients. And people are, of course, now getting used to working on several teams at once, which means they tend to get a lot more variety in their work as well.
Yes. And how about the technology? How do you help your teleworkers cope with it?
Well, people working from home have, I suppose, had to become more independent about coping with technology. But our corporate intranet is the largest in Europe, and we've invested a lot of time and money in making sure there's enough online support for anyone using it. Oh, and there is some training available, of course.
Hmm. And what's been the impact so far?
Well, it's difficult to say whether productivity's risen or not, but surveys show that since people have had access to work 24 hours a day, they've been working a lot longer days. In fact, we've just implemented a new training programme to help managers recognise this and deal with the situation. Because although some people might produce their best work under this kind of pressure, it's certainly not the case for everyone.
Was that one of the challenges when implementing the programme?
Yes, as was getting the general concept over. We've also had to adapt to the diversity of our flexible workers. It's not unusual, say, for 400 of them to be on the intranet at midnight.
Midnight?
Yeah.
So what happens when these people need stationery or when their computer crashes?
We've had to develop 24-hour, 365-day-a-year support services. I'd say that was probably our toughest challenge, actually.
And how have people adapted to working in these virtual teams?
Well, so far, very well. New teams usually meet at the start of a project. Of course, you can always find out about the other team members on the company intranet even before you meet them. After the first meeting, most communication is then done by email, so we've had to work out guidelines on how to use email more effectively. At the start, we experienced some difficulties with people circulating far too much irrelevant information. And, of course, there's always one or two people who resist any form of change whatsoever.
And finally, how do you see the future of the office itself?
Well, I think flexible working's bound to increase, but there'll always be a place for the office. There'll always be a need for face-to-face contact, because even teams working remotely still need to get together every now and again to refocus. Being tied to the desk, however, is history. In future, mobile personal information systems will have all the tools we need for our jobs. And the days of putting bits of paper in drawers are definitely numbered, I'm afraid.
Unit 2A. Stocks and Shares. Listening 1.
Now, internet stocks. They were going through the roof earlier this year until they ran into their recent difficulties. So the question is, has the bubble finally burst? Our technology correspondent, Katie Johnson, joins me in the studio. So, Katie, first of all, what drove these prices up so high in the first place?
Well, all the hype about the internet would have attracted some investors looking for a quick profit. But I think the real driving force has been the fact that demand has far exceeded a limited supply. There were only a handful of internet share offers last year, so opportunities to jump onto the internet bandwagon have been very limited.
And all this is despite the fact they are far from what you'd call a safe investment.
Absolutely, yes.
But what about good old profits? Do they match the performance of the share prices?
Well, this is what's so fascinating. Take Amazon.com, for example, the internet bookseller. They have a market value of $18 billion, turnover in excess of $1 billion, and yet they haven't even reached the break-even point. Apart from a couple of companies, such as Yahoo and America Online, most of them are a long, long way away from making any kind of profit whatsoever, never mind the huge profits everyone's hoping for.
So why on earth is everyone so keen to invest in them?
Well, they're very trendy. And, of course, there's always the brand factor, which is another reason. Companies like Yahoo and America Online now enjoy incredibly high brand awareness. But the real attraction is the tremendous potential for future revenue, particularly from advertising. Yahoo already has 144 million page hits a day and nearly 2,000 advertisers. And with internet usage expected to double within 5 years, advertising spending is bound to increase.
But then how do analysts value these companies?
Well, it's not easy. They have few assets in the traditional sense, and they all show phenomenal growth in terms of turnover. So analysts are having to rely on alternative yardsticks to compare them.
Such as
things like audience reach. Lycos, another search engine like Yahoo, saw its shares jump by more than a third recently when figures came out saying it reached 45% of all home internet users.
So, let's turn to the recent collapse in these share prices. Has the bubble finally burst?
Well, we were due a sell-off, so it's not surprising that shareholders took advantage of the recent sharp rises. But I think what's really depressed prices is the flood of internet companies that have floated recently and saturated the market with their shares. It seems that supply and demand are now levelling out. In fact, several companies have even seen their shares slide below the offer price. So, yes, enthusiasm does seem to be cooling.
Well, it seems to me that anyone investing in internet shares is in for a bit of a roller coaster ride. So, just why is the market so volatile?
Well, it's a very young market, don't forget. And many companies have been listed for only a couple of months. Also, a lot of people who invest in these stocks actually use the internet to trade online. Without the broker's commission, they can afford to buy in and out of stocks several times a day. This makes the market very sensitive to any breaking news. And I think it's this responsiveness which makes it so volatile.
So, Katie, the big question. What's the market going to do next?
Well, Richard, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Some of the prices being paid do reflect the value of these companies, so I can't really see prices falling much more. And although confidence will return, enthusiasm is cooling. So don't expect to see prices soaring in the near future.
So really the future for companies in this sector?
Well, I think the sector's going to see lots of consolidation activity as the market share. Lycos, for example, has just acquired Hotbot, one of its rivals. We'll also see one or two large established non-internet companies looking to enter the market. The giant German publisher, for example, has just entered into a joint venture with US bookseller Barnes & Noble to challenge Amazon's dominance on the net. And if the internet continues to grow like it is, then a few of these companies are bound to returns on their investments.
Listening to.
Now, earlier, you mentioned Amazon.com, the internet bookseller, and I believe you're going to show us a graph illustrating what's been happening to their shares over the last 12 months.
Yes, and here it is. Now, this example really is typical of what's been happening throughout this whole sector. As you can see, there was a general upward trend in the first 6 months, with shares going from just $14 to over $100 a share by December last year. But then in January this year, they really took off, soaring to almost $200. Predictably enough, I suppose, investors took advantage of these sharp gains, and we saw a sell-off, which meant that by February, Amazon's shares had fallen back to their December level again.
So we've seen one sell-off this year already then?
Yes, and that's why I don't think there's any real need to panic about current losses, because as we can see here, there was a very strong recovery, and by May, they'd more than doubled in value again, peaking at nearly $220. So I think the recent losses were fairly predictable. But having said that, the price has collapsed by nearly 50% in the last 4 weeks. And finally, there we have today's price, down almost $6 at just over $111.
Unit 2B, Mergers and Acquisitions. Listening.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Brown from the Zeneca Public Affairs Department. I'm here today to tell you a little bit more about the merger between Zeneca and the Swedish pharmaceuticals company Astra. So first of all, the boards of Astra and Zeneca have announced that there is to be an all-share merger of the two companies. The new company will be called AstraZeneca. I'll begin by going through the rationale for the merger and listing some of its benefits. Then I'll go on to give some details about the new board and talk about the financial effects of the merger. And finally, I'll give a brief summary of the terms, including details about dividends and so on. The merger is a natural step for both partners, as they both share the same science-based culture as well as a common vision concerning the future of the industry. The benefits of this move are many. To begin with, the merged group will have an enhanced ability to create long-term growth and increased value for its shareholders. Furthermore, it'll be able to deliver the full potential of its existing and future products through the joint strength and worldwide presence of its global sales and marketing operations. In fact, based on the joint pharmaceutical sales for last year, the AstraZeneca Group will be the third largest pharmaceutical company in the world. The combined strength of the two R&D functions will also ensure an excellent basis for innovation-led growth. With a combined R&D spend of nearly $2 billion, AstraZeneca will be one of the largest R&D organizations in the world, which will mean that the company will also be of great interest to academic institutions and biotech companies seeking partners for their research programs. At a strategic level, management is hoping that the merger will create sizable operational efficiencies by restructuring areas of duplication. It has been calculated that synergies resulting from the merger could lead to cost reductions of over $1 billion within the next 3 years. Although this sounds like a somewhat optimistic figure, we are quite confident that it can be achieved through streamlining the workforce, particularly in areas like administration, and a restructuring of the two sales operations. Moving on to the board now, the board of AstraZeneca will be drawn equally from the two companies, with Tom McKillop, the chief executive, running the company along with his executive team. The board will be headed by Percy Barnevik, the non-executive chairman, whose job it will be to check that strategy and policy are periodically reviewed and agreement is maintained. The two deputy chairmen, Sir David Barnes and Håkon Mogren, both have extensive experience of the pharmaceutical industry and business in general. They will be available to advise and support the chief executive as necessary.
Unit 3B. Entering a market. Listening.
So, what's it like actually doing business with the Chinese? Well, it's difficult to describe because in China there's still no commonly shared perception of what's reasonable or normal in international business, so standards and expectations vary widely from place to place. That's why, when you're doing business in China, it's imperative that you do extensive preparatory work. This means finding out about the particular company, industry, city or region where you're doing business, and not just about the country as a whole. One of the first things to remember is that the Chinese find it most discourteous if you are late for meetings. It may be, of course, that your first meeting will be in your hotel, but if not, then allow plenty of time for the journey, as in most Chinese cities the congestion is every bit as bad as in London. A good tip is to take a business card with the company's address written in Chinese to show the taxi driver. When you get there, you will be greeted by your host, usually a senior manager, and probably some of his or her staff. The visitors will then be ushered into the meeting room. The leader of your group will be expected to enter first, and will generally be offered a seat beside the most senior Chinese person present. This person will usually chair the meeting and act as host and have a translator at his or her side. To begin with, all those present will swap business cards, in itself a very important ceremony, and there will be a short period of small talk. The host will then officially start proceedings with a brief introduction to the Chinese enterprise and its activities. The host may then invite the visiting team to speak. Now, at this point, it's appropriate for the UK side to begin to make its case. Don't forget to warn your host beforehand if you wish to include any audiovisual aids during this presentation. It's also extremely important that your team should be able to answer any questions on any aspect of your business proposal, your own company, and your international competitors. Following the meeting, the Chinese enterprise will probably arrange a special dinner for the UK guests. Small talk over dinner is essential for relationship building. For most Chinese, the family counts above all else. It remains the dominant social and political unit in Chinese society, so Chinese people will usually be very pleased to be asked about their children and their hopes for their children's future. In social relationships, Chinese people almost always seek to preserve harmony and face. Hosts believe it is their duty to offer their visitors hospitality, even though the visitors themselves may much prefer a day off after intense negotiations. It's very common, for instance, for the host enterprise to organise sightseeing trips for its guests, and it would, of course, be a discourtesy not to accept these invitations.
Unit 4A, The Future of Work. Listening.
So, Jan, why did BA decide to move to Waterside?
Well, we had a lot of people scattered about in a lot of different buildings. British Airways has been around a long time, so we've inherited a lot of old offices and buildings. Leases were running out on a lot of key buildings on the Heathrow site, and we decided that rather than try to renew them, it would make more sense for us financially to build a new building on this site. So although it was a £200 million project, it was in fact a cost-effective move for BA.
But why such a radically different building? What was the main objective?
Well, we knew from opinion surveys that our work environment needed improving. When designing the building, we very much wanted to realise a vision which was team-based and spaced, one that involved bringing people together in an open working environment. We now have an excellent facility where people can meet and work anywhere in the building, and by centralising our information and data, we can now work together much more effectively than before. We also looked at informality and ways of reducing hierarchy.
Such as?
Physically, we used to have a very hierarchical setup. PAs, for example, used to sit right outside the manager's office, and we questioned whether that kind of system really helped the way we worked. We also looked at things like the size and purpose of office space, and we made small changes like not allocating executive parking.
So how is the building laid out?
Right. The building itself was designed around a village structure. What we've got is a central street with six houses coming off it. It's designed so residents, that's the people who work here, park in a secure area beneath the building and then come up through the street. This means they have to walk through the street to get to their place of work, wherever that might be that day. And the idea there was very much, and it does work, that we would all be very visible and we would stop and talk or bump into each other at the shop or the bank. So again, everyone, whatever their level, comes through the building the same way.
So if someone can be working anywhere in the building, how do you find them?
It's very simple. All the phones in the building are dumb terminals. So wherever I am in the building, I can log into the system as 95001, which activates that particular terminal and directs all my calls to it. So I'm always 95001, whether I'm in the building or even at home. We also have voicemail and an electronic diary system, just in case people are unavailable. And obviously there are maps in the street and information points as well.
Going back to the street for a moment, I noticed there are lots of high street facilities. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, it's very clear that people need to do things like pop to the bank or pick up shopping or whatever. Normally, if you want to do those things, you're going to have to dash out at lunchtime or after work. So what we've done is identify what people need to do, and we've just made them available on site. It's a convenience thing, that's all.
All right, yes, that's handy. Now, I believe you've also looked at changing the meetings culture.
Yes, we're encouraging people on the classics, really. making sure you need a meeting and that you're inviting the right people. I suppose we're suggesting that we wouldn't expect a useful meeting to be bigger than, say, 20 people. But we've got a lot of flexibility. I can choose a location suited to the type of meeting I want to run. There's everything from the cafes and informal meeting rooms right up to the theatre, which seats 400 people.
So what difference has Waterside made to your typical day?
Right. Well, first thing in the morning, I have a choice of whether I come into Waterside or not, because I've got a laptop and access to the computer network from home or from other sites. So what I've tended to do is try and book meetings all on the same day if I can, as it cuts down my travelling time, basically. And if I do come into Waterside, I've just got more options. I really feel I get things done quicker and more effectively, and that I'm making better use of my time.
Unit 4B. E-Business. Listening.
Well, it's already made a huge impact, and by the time the project's fully implemented, we'll have networked over 300,000 employees and suppliers. They'll all be able to communicate through email, and it's this interconnectivity is changing everything about the way we work. I mean, last year, around 15% of our in-service staff development was carried out through web-based distance learning using the company intranet. And we reckon that for every 1,000 days of classroom-based teaching that's supplied by distance learning, it generates about $500,000 in efficiency gains. And this year, we'll be delivering up to 30% of our courses by distance learning, so we'll be looking at savings of over $100 million.
We're one of the largest insurance organisations in Canada, offering a wide range of financial products. We rely on a system of independent agents to distribute our products, so it's really important to maintain a close relationship with them. This used to be done over the telephone, but that was all very time-consuming for our employees and meant we could only supply agents with information during office hours. Now we have the extranet, which means that all our representatives can keep in touch around the clock and get the latest information about offerings. They can also request backup articles and information such as telemarketing scripts and advertisements. And of course, we'll be introducing more and more new product lines, so it's essential that our agents get the backup they need.
We're one of the Netherlands' leading banks, with 1,300 branches here and abroad. We deal with both businesses and consumers, but our primary focus is small and medium-sized businesses, SMBs, as we call them. As part of our offering to SMBs, we recently launched a web-based Euro project, which provides free briefings to both customers and staff about the new European currency. Since the issues surrounding the Euro will constantly be changing, people will need regular updating. By providing up-to-the-minute bulletins, we're establishing ourselves as a major player in the Eurozone countries. This, in turn, is enhancing our clients' perceptions of us and strengthening our customer base.
Well, we are one of France's most prestigious bicycle manufacturers, selling mainly to professionals and people with a real passion for cycling as a sport. The best bit about our new website is that it lets customers actually design their own personalized cyber cycle. All they have to do is choose a basic model and then decide what frame, wheels, pedals, color, and so on they want. They pay online by credit card, and the bike is then delivered to their nearest dealer within 14 days. It's as simple as that. Our business was initially aimed at mostly French customers, but with a new way of using the internet, we have been able to create an international presence at a fraction of what it would have cost to advertise outside the domestic market.
After recent restructuring, we felt we needed to change the company culture to reflect our leaner structure. Processes that used to be highly bureaucratized needed to be simplified. One area we really had to tackle was procurement. After filling in massive amounts of paperwork, getting requisite signatures and then faxing orders off, our employees sometimes had to wait over a month for things like office material and PCs to get here. A real advantage with the new system is there's less margin for error because If the form isn't filled in correctly, then the system says so immediately, so less time will be wasted on sorting out problems. By the end of the year, we'll have reduced our paper invoices from 5 million to zero.
Unit 5A. Staff motivation. Listening.
Well, I've only been here a few months, but I feel as if I've fitted in quite well so far. Everyone seems to have time to talk to me when I need help, which I really appreciate. The work's beginning to get interesting too. It's just that by now, I feel I really should be getting up to speed. Only it's a relatively new position and nobody's really spelt out what the exact scope of the job is, or what my responsibilities and priorities should be. I think my line manager needs to give me a more concrete idea of what she expects me to achieve. She's back from holiday next week, so maybe we could sit down together then.
Well, I get the feeling that we're starting to fall a bit behind other companies. I mean, when you look in the papers, you can't help noticing that there's a bit of a gap between ourselves and the current going rate. I mean, it's not that I'm unhappy here or anything. I really like my job. It's interesting work, and I think it's great that the job's so flexible. It's just that, at the end of the day, nobody likes to feel undervalued, do they? And in my position, it's not just myself I've got to think about. I've got responsibilities outside work as well.
Well, it's great to be part of a successful team. I don't think you could wish for harder working and more dedicated colleagues. But I just sometimes think that our efforts aren't always rewarded. I know different managers have different styles, but, well, everyone likes to feel appreciated, don't they? I mean, in my last job, managers always made a point of praising us when we beat our targets. One manager even used to encourage us to clap and cheer each other. And I must admit, I do miss that at times. I find praise here is sometimes a bit, shall we say, limited. It's like there's a that's-what-you're-paid-for type of attitude.
I suppose, on the whole, I've got very little to complain about, really. I get on with the rest of the team and that kind of thing. But there's one thing that's been on my mind for a while now. I just feel that, well, I've reached a stage where I'm capable of dealing with a lot more responsibility than I do at present. I just don't feel stretched anymore. I don't feel as though I'm contributing as much as I could. It's almost as if I'm on autopilot. Things are beginning to feel a bit stale. What I need is a bit of variety, something to get my teeth into, a challenge.
Well, you're probably already aware of the fact that things aren't functioning too smoothly in production at the moment. I don't know what other people have said, but personally, I think it's down to our procedures. There's no formal system for putting our ideas forward, and in the past, suggestions have just been ignored. I think management has to accept a lot of the responsibility. What we need to do is schedule regular meetings which will improve the flow of information in both directions. I mean, at the moment, I get more information through the shop floor grapevine than from my line manager.